This is All In. I am Taylor Bennett. Today we're talking about the Asian American community and the concept of the model minority. If you have questions or comments on our show today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. That number is 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. You can also send us high-quality voice messages with our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. We're joined now by Ellen Wu. Ellen is an associate professor of history and the director of the Asian American Studies Program at Indiana University Bloomington. And she's also the author of The Color of Success, Asian Americans and the Origins of the Model Minority. Ellen, thank you so much for taking time today to speak with us.
Thanks, Taylor. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, we're very excited to have you. First, I want to ask you a little bit about your work as the director of Asian American Studies at IU.
Sure. So for those who might not know, in the late 1960s, student activists around the country began pushing for what they called ethnic studies, which was really a new body of knowledge that they wanted to be researched and taught in schools that focused primarily on communities of color, with the goal that the knowledge produced would serve their communities. Now, if we fast forward from the 1960s and 70s to the late 80s and 90s, students at IU Bloomington were very interested in creating an Asian American Studies program for these very reasons. It did take a while, but after joining forces with other students of color, a student movement that really peaked in the 1990s and was a very exciting time, I think, at Bloomington, IU Bloomington did create officially an Asian American Studies program in 2007-2008. And so I, along with colleagues of mine, were hired team members with the intention that over time we would do the research and the teaching and the service to build this program. So I have been directing this program since 2015.
How big is the program today?
I would say it's actually pretty small. I like to think we're small but mighty. One problem we have is that we've got a lot of great faculty on campus who research and teach on Asian Americans, but the way that our faculty positions are structured doesn't allow them necessarily to teach for this program. So that's something we're working on so that we can build out. We offer usually 2 to 3 courses a semester for undergraduate students. We do have a minor. You can minor in Asian American Studies. And we're hoping to allow a PhD minor eventually and just to keep building on what we have.
Well, why do you think it's important for specifically Asian Americans to have their own program?
Well, I do want to stress, Taylor, that this program isn't just for Asian Americans. Obviously, it's open to all students, and we think we have something to offer to everybody. But in particular, why it's important to have a program that focuses on Asian American and Pacific Islander communities, I think, is because a lot of times these communities just remain totally invisible to many people who aren't from these populations. And these populations, you know, do have a lot of concerns and issues that go unaddressed if, you know, if they can't even be seen or known, right, by policymakers and, you know, community leaders and so forth. So I believe that is a contribution that we can make with this program. And I think for Asian American students in particular, it's one of the first times when they get to IU that, you know, they get to take a class that focuses on the histories and the concerns of their communities, which is not, you know, not often something that they've ever run into, you know, in their earlier education mm-hmm. or on the news, in popular culture. Yeah, there's this definite feeling of being overlooked or invisible.
I think it's interesting. You're the author of a book, and it's a really interesting view and a lot of information that you put together. The book is called The Color of Success, Asian Americans and the Origins of the Model Minority. First of all, tell me a little bit about that process of you putting that book together, and then we'll talk a little more about the model minority.
Sure. So I am trained as a historian of the United States, and I did both a master's degree in Asian American Studies at UCLA, but I got my PhD in history at the University of Chicago. And to get a PhD in history, you have to write a research-driven dissertation. And when I had to come up with a topic, I wanted to write a dissertation that would become a book that would answer what I thought was a very puzzling question, which was how Asian Americans went from being regarded as what people call the yellow peril, sometimes the brown hordes, right, this threatening menace to American society, really from the 19th century all the way through World War II. But how Asian Americans got from that yellow peril image to what we might call today the so-called model minority, that is hardworking, successful, upwardly mobile, but also, you know, quiet, keeping their heads down and just sort of, doing what it takes to succeed in American life. And to me, they seem to be a very striking, racial makeover. And it seemed like a 180-degree, pivot. So I wanted to really research the historical origins of that evolution. And that's what led me to ultimately to writing this book.
And the model minority, specifically, what does that entail?
Well, what it entails is, and I think this will be familiar to many of the listeners out there, American society is infused with race in every dimension of our life. And of course, one way that takes shapes is in the form of racial stereotypes. So if we think about Asian Americans in particular, that is people with origins in East Asia, Southeast Asia, or South Asia, I would say that the dominant stereotype that, lords over us today is that of the model minority. Again, that we're this hardworking, studious, successful, upwardly mobile racial group, and the explanation for that is that we Asian Americans supposedly carry in our DNA these cultural traits that hardwire us to succeed in American life. But I would also say that there's a political dimension to that, which is that Asian Americans also they keep their heads down, they don't make a lot of noise, and why people call it the model minority is because that stereotype of Asians is often used to really compare in a very negative sense, that is to say, to discredit the political engagement and activism of African Americans and other people of color.
How far did you go back?
This book starts, my book starts with World War II, mm-hmm. and I trace it through the 1950s and 1960s.
I suppose there, when you look at it, there's going to be positive aspects to it and also negative to the model minority. Can you kind of highlight some of both positive and negative sides to it?
Sure. That's a really good question. On the face of it, a model minority stereotype sounds very flattering, right? It sounds very positive. Why shouldn't you want to be praised for working hard and succeeding? I mean, those are the values that America, stands for, right? The American dream. But I think there's some really important negative dimensions. The first one is that, obviously, I would say that it throws everybody into this bucket, right? A very diverse community. Today, there are almost 20 million Asian Americans from all kinds of backgrounds, and not everybody is doing well. There are a lot of poor folks, people really struggling. 16% of our population is undocumented. So by just painting everybody with this, broad brushstrokes that we're model minorities, it just papers over a lot of real deep concerns and struggles that people have. And the second major negative implication of the model minority stereotype is that comparative aspect. And what I tried to show in my research, and I really do think I have shown is that by the 1960s, one of the key ways that Americans understood Asians was that they were what I call decidedly or definitively not Black, that the racial position of Asians in American society was very much about being not Black. And so if Asians, you know, got ahead because they had strong families and their kids didn't get into trouble, you know, they didn't have like a criminal element, you know, again, supposedly, this was supposed to be the opposite of Black folks. And that was really a useful way for, I would say, policymakers and social scientists, people across, you know, influential people to discredit the demands of civil rights activists, Black power organizers, and so forth. So it's a way to undermine racial justice.
It really is an interesting way to view it. It's a different way.
I think so. I think usually, you know, again, if we just think about common ways that Asian Americans appear, like, you know, in our public life, it's like, oh, these Indian kids are, you know, winners of the spelling bee, you know, or there's like Asian scientists. But there's a much longer history of there that's deeply entangled, I would say, with Black history and just sort of the history of racial justice in general. So it really is important for us as a country to look at this stereotype very critically.
And I suppose you can also look at it affecting those outside of the Asian American community, correct?
Yes, I think so. Again, that's I'll give you a different example. The last chapter of my book looks at the history of Hawaii statehood. And I think what a lot of people don't really fully realize is that Hawaii was once an independent kingdom that the United States forcibly conquered and colonized by 1898. It went through a period as a territory of the United States. And a lot of white people, essentially, in the early part of the 20th century, did not want to admit Hawaii to become a state because most of the population was either Asian or Native Hawaiian, and especially Asian. There were Asian workers who had been essentially imported to work on the sugar plantations.
Well, Ellen, I hate to interrupt you. We're going to have to take just a quick break, but we will be back. We'll talk more about the model minority when we come back after our break. Again, if you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Taylor Bennett. We'll be right back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. We're talking today about the Asian American community and how the stereotypes around it affect people within and also outside of the community. We're joined today by Ellen Wu. Ellen is an associate professor of history and director of the Asian American Studies program at Indiana University Bloomington. Welcome back, Ellen.
Thank you, Taylor.
Yeah, as before we went to break, you were talking about the model minority and specifically how it affects people outside of the Asian American community.
Yes. Well, I would just say what I started to talk about, the larger point here being that when the United States, when Americans finally agreed that it would be beneficial to admit Hawaii to become a state, the 50th state, there was a lot of model minority discussion in the 1940s and 1950s because the population of Hawaii at that time was majority Asian. So people talked about how Hawaii was this racial paradise where everybody got along. And in some ways, the kind of polar opposite of the roiling racial tensions on the U.S. mainland, especially the South, the U.S. South in the 1950s. But the argument that I make in the book is that because the model minority concept really helped to push through Hawaii's statehood, what it did was really obscure all the problems and issues that Native Hawaiians faced. You know, the indigenous people of Hawaii had suffered under United States domination and colonial rule. So today, what is I think notable is that a lot of times in the kind of racial categorization, you know, of the United States, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders get grouped together. And there's a history of a reasoning for that. But I do think it's really important to note that because of that lumping together, Pacific Islander issues really get ignored. And many of those issues are quite dire. So that answers, I think, your question mm-hmm. about other communities getting impacted.
Do you think that's still true today?
Oh, it's absolutely true. And I do think among different folks who advocate for Pacific Islander communities, you know, many of those folks have really pressed the point that and I think Asian Americans, too, that we need to often pull apart this very general and diverse category and look more closely at individual communities so we can better understand the issues people face.
Well, what do you think then Asian Americans need to recognize to have these productive conversations around racism in their communities?
I'm really glad you asked this question. In 2020, I think, like for many Americans, the question of anti-Black racism has really come to the forefront. I will say that there have been Asian Americans for decades who have really worked on dismantling anti-Black racism. But what is striking to me is how many more people are taking part in this conversation now. I think big issues right Asian Americans is build coalitions and solidarity with Black folks and to really figure out how we can be good allies to Black people, even as we work on our own the racism and discrimination that our community faces. So it's tricky in a way, but I think it can be done.
Well, how do you see or how do you vision that those conversations around anti-Black racism in the Asian American community play out? What does that look like? What does that sound like?
I would say, first of all, that the Asian American community is incredibly diverse, not just in a socioeconomic way, but also ideologically and politically, right? So there are people all across the spectrum. And I think that has been reflected in the kind of conversations people have had. Among young Asian Americans, I think there's been a lot of incredible energy about what they call Asians for Black Lives, thinking about how Asian Americans can be good allies and working on issues that affect Black communities in the most dire ways, such as like police violence, right? Police brutality is one example, as we saw with George Floyd and others. And so there's been a lot of really important work where young people are writing messages to their families and translating them into different Asian languages so they can begin these very difficult and challenging conversations with their own family members. I think that's just a really terrific example. But I'll give you a different example. I think that is also really inspiring to me. Among the folks who have been obviously one of the big stories of the 2020 elections was Georgia flipping, right? Blue. And one of the communities that was really invested in this Georgia Democratic coalition was the Asian American community, right? And the different subcommunities under that umbrella. So I think that there are actual, like, real substantive, meaningful ways that Asian Americans are trying to do this solidarity work, really, so that we can all live in a country that, takes care of our people.
Right, right. You mentioned earlier, too, younger Asian Americans, and this idea of the model minority myth has been talked about more recently, it seems. Why is this called a myth?
That's a great question, too. It's called a myth because it certainly distorts a lot of the realities, the kind of day-to-day realities of Asian Americans. One way I like to explain this, for example, when I'm teaching about it, is that if you look at let's say, socioeconomic trends among Asian Americans, they're often what social scientists would call, bifurcated, which is to say, yes, there are certainly a good number of Asian Americans who are doing well in the sense of, let's say, household income or educational level. But there are also a lot of folks at the other end of the spectrum, right? People living below the poverty line or really struggling. Certainly in 2020, people have been, losing jobs and so forth. I can give you a different example, which is that one group that I've become part of recently is the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. We have a new chapter in Indiana. And one of the issues we work on is what we call economic justice. And this group, which we call NAPA for short, we've been highlighting that, upcoming is our Equal Pay Day for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. And it's March 7th because it takes Asian American women and Pacific Islander women, they have to work all the way up to March 7th of 2021 to make, on average, the same amount of money that a white man made in 2020. So there's a wage disparity, right? And this kind of issue is definitely, I would say, hidden by this model minority stereotype. And that's why people call it a myth.
Okay. I want to go back to what you said about the chapter that is around. Tell us a little more about that chapter that was put together.
The chapter, yes. Mm-hmm. So this group, National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum, is a national organization that began in 1996. That is a progressive organization, really interested in reproductive health issues, economic justice issues, and immigration and racial justice issues. In, I think, 2018 or 2019, some folks in Indiana decided they wanted to start a chapter. The goal is really to build a statewide network of progressive people who really care about these issues, particularly as they affect Asian American and Pacific Islander women, girls, and non-binary people. So I'm really proud to say that in 2020, our big project was a Get Out the Vote campaign in Indiana, where we did phone banking essentially for 16 weeks, and we made about 2,500 calls. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, really, as far as we know, this is the first targeted effort to mobilize Asian American and Pacific Islander voters. It was a nonpartisan effort, but, people that we called said nobody's ever reached out to them. So I think this is something really noteworthy, and I'm really excited about.
Yeah, that's interesting. And good feedback, too, I think, that it sounds like you got.
I think so. And I really think if we look just beyond Indiana and think about nationally, because I'm interested in this issue, I noticed there was a lot of media coverage in the election cycle about Asian American and Pacific Islander voters. If you look at Georgia, Georgia's a great example. I saw one statistic where the turnout of Asian American voters went up by a 91% as compared to the last presidential election. So there's a lot of untapped energy. And I think that right now, both Democrats and Republicans, at least the formal party machines, they haven't really, done the work to reach out to these communities and really figure out where they the needs that they need to meet with us.
Well, it sounds like having organizations like this is very important, not only in Indiana, but just, around the country, to have these types of organizations looking at this and addressing this.
Oh, I agree. And of course, NAPAF's not the only one. Other groups like Asian Americans Advancing Justice, they're working really hard. But for sure, this is one part of the electorate that's fast growing and I think has the potential to make a real impact.
Do you think Indiana needs more groups like this? I mean, what could we do, or just what can be done to help these groups?
I do think Indiana needs more groups like this. I'm born and raised in Indiana, and this is really the first time I've seen something like this. So I think part of it is about, just educating people, even knowing where people live and where they exist and what matters to them is important. I also want to just stress that people might think Asian Americans only care about like getting their kids into Harvard, but Asian Americans care about so much more than that. Climate change, healthcare, there's so many issues. You know, they care about the same issues that everybody cares about, but sometimes they have very unique needs, including, you know, language differences. So I do think there is a big niche to fill with these types of organizations.
You know, Ellen, you know, there's been a lot of news lately surrounding the Asian American community. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about a woman, the first woman, a woman of color, a woman of South Asian heritage that serves as vice president now. What do you think that means to the Asian American community to have this kind of representation on this high scale?
I think there's so much excitement that Kamala Harris is the vice president of the United States and that she has roots, you know, in immigrant communities in India as well as Jamaica, and that I think for South Asian folks, that impact has just been huge. You know, it's, you know, we're talking about there. If you look in just like our media landscape, there's so few people that look like us. And then if you look in, you know, in terms of politicians, I mean, you can say the same, or they're clumped together in very specific geographical locations like California. So I feel like it's just been a really energizing moment to have Kamala Harris elected to office. And I also think it's like for those of us who are progressive, I think there's something really exciting in thinking about how she, you know, she has ties to lots of different communities, and it's in some ways like a metaphor, I guess, right? A symbol of this kind of cross-coalitional type of promise.
All right. I mean, you look at it. I mean, first you have a woman, right, that's in this position, but also, you know, Asian American. So like you said, I think this representation is really going to play out very interesting and putting some attention not only on, you know, but she's a woman, but also of an Asian American in that community. I mean, how do you think that's going to play out down the road, you think, as far as of that kind of attention?
I think, you know, I've seen just different kinds of reports, media reports and stories talking about, for example, how excited Indian Americans are with her election. But I think maybe the biggest way that this may play out is kind of going back to earlier parts of our conversation, mm-hmm. which is that, you know, the model minority myth often assumes that Asian Americans just don't care about politics, right? They're apolitical, they're disengaged. I think Kamala Harris shows us, you know, that's not true, and the excitement around her, and then the whole voter turnout and engagement, all of this huge, you know, energy in 2020 under these very unusual circumstances of the pandemic. I think that it's a really hopeful sign of our civic engagement.
You talk about voter turnout. Are Asian Americans active voters in their communities?
I would say that it is traditionally it's been uneven. And there are different reasons for that, right? Including not everybody is a U.S. citizen. Asian Americans make up maybe about 27% of the foreign-born immigrant population. And again, some 15-16% of Asian Americans are undocumented. So we have to take that into account. But overall, I do think that there is a lot of growth potential. And as we've seen in this election in 2020, this was, for many people, a first time going to the polls. So I would say, you know, that we have this uneven engagement, but it is certainly it is growing.
Well, it maybe goes back to what you're talking about with these organizations that are out there working, right, to get out there, to talk to people, to ask them what issues are they concerned about.
Yeah, I think so. You know, if you feel like nobody cares about you, that I think that's sort of like a disincentive to get involved. But if there's going to be outreach and people really sincere and interested in learning about who you are and what you care about and what you struggle with, I think that that works the other way, that it's an incentive to become more involved, whether that's locally at the state level or, you know, at the national level.
Yeah. Do you think that that is a concern, that they don't feel like people care what they think?
I do think that's a concern. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, I'm, you know, a native Hoosier, born and raised here. And I don't have a sense that our policymakers in Indiana really think at all about Asian Americans very much, you know, just like just in passing. Unlike in other states, there's no state level entity that is like a direct pipeline to, let's say, the governor or people at the state level office. So I'd love to see, and I think many of my friends in our NAPOF chapter would love to see some kind of Asian American Pacific Islander advisory committee, for instance, for Indiana, just as one concrete example. I think there's so much, you know, we have a lot to offer, but we also need to, I feel like our leaders need to meet us halfway.
I agree. All right. Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with an Asian American educator about the Asian American community, Ellen Wu, associate professor of history and also the director of the Asian American Studies program at Indiana University Bloomington. She's also the author of The Color of Success, Asian Americans and the Origins of the Model Minority. We'll be back to talk more with Ellen. Now we're going to a break. I'm Taylor Bennett. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Back now to our discussion on the Asian American community and the concept of the model minority. Ellen, welcome back.
Thanks.
Let's move on to reports of hate crimes against elderly Asian Americans across the country. I've seen videos of this, and it's just heartbreaking to watch. Why do you think that this has been happening recently?
Yeah, I can't even watch the videos. Why it's been happening recently, I think there's a pretty clear connection between the really going back to the Trump administration and how Trump himself really from the top has really made COVID-19 a racial issue. You know, by repeatedly calling it the China virus or Kung flu, and with that kind of racially infused language, racist language, that has, I would say, egged on in some ways people to express their anxieties about the pandemic in these hostile and violent ways. But I will just note this, that there's a long history. So it's not all just Trump. I mean, there's a long history going back to the 1850s and 60s and 70s of Americans associating Chinese immigrants and other Asians with, you know, disease and pollution and just a sense of cultural difference that is, you know, threatening to American people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hate crimes in general. I mean, it's just, you know, it's hard to watch, and something obviously has to be done. How do you think the situation can be improved?
I do think one way that it can be improved is what Asian Americans themselves are already doing, which is, first of all, at the very least, collecting information and documentation of what's going on, just so we have a data-driven, you know, portrait of the issue, and we know exactly where these incidents are happening. And then taking that information and, you know, encouraging policymakers, not just at the federal level, but really, this is truly, again, where our state and local policymakers really make a difference, to think about how you know, there can be more robust consequences for hate crimes, certainly more better education, I think, mm-hmm. term project where so ordinary, you know, people can remember and hopefully restrain themselves. You know, I understand there is a lot of, this pandemic is awful and it is awful for everybody. But the way to express and deal with that awfulness is certainly not through violence and hostility against people that haven't, you know, done anything. So I would say, yeah, better information and more robust policy and consequences for folks who unfortunately do end up acting out in these ways.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, too, there's a pretty big size population, Burmese communities in the state, and they've been particularly vocal about this recent coup that's been going on. Do you think Asian Americans have been this vocal about issues going on in their home countries in the past?
Yes, there's a very long history of Asian American engagement, trans-Pacific engagement with their home countries or sending countries. And there's, I think, different reasons. You know, one reason is that for a long time, Asian Americans, Asian immigrants could not become U.S. citizens by law. So for that very reason, the only government they could turn to advocate for them would be their home governments, right? This is all before the 1940s and the 1950s. But I think Asian Americans just really understand that the relations that the United States has with their home countries often makes a difference in their lives, for good or for bad. The most extreme examples would be the World War II era incarceration of Japanese Americans by the federal government because the U.S. was at war with Japan. And, you know, military and civilian leaders made the case that any Japanese American might be a spy for Japan. And another example of that really is since 9/11 and the extreme hostility and hatred that we've seen against Muslim Americans, you know, some of whom are, you know, also Asian Americans. So that I think those two examples make it so clear that Asian Americans, we do live, you know, we live out these consequences often of the relations that the United States has with other parts of the world.
You know, I think relationships with law enforcement is also very important, too. And some say that not everyone in the Asian American community has the same relationship with law enforcement that maybe some other communities don't feel like they can, you know, can't rely on police to protect them. Do you think that's the case with Asian Americans?
So you're asking, what is the relationship with law enforcement?
What do you think? What is the relationship? Do you think there's trust there?
Again, it's one of those issues I think is uneven. So I would answer that in a couple ways. You know, there's a long history, I think, of suspicion or skepticism of federal authorities that really goes back to this history of Asian exclusion. And the fact, if we look at the Chinese community, you know, so the Chinese folks were really the original undocumented immigrants because there were exclusion laws that prevented them from coming to the U.S. Many people came on false documents. So there is a long history of people wary of any kind of interaction with the state that might get them into, you know, trouble. On the other hand, I think because Asian Americans aren't criminal, like assumed to be criminal in the ways that Black people are, that that in some ways that actually makes it easier for Asian Americans to turn to law enforcement when they feel like they need to, if that makes sense,
mm-hmm.
Because there's just less of a probability that an encounter with law enforcement may end, you know, lethally, you know, in death or, you know, violence. So that's a way, in the kind of perverse way, I think, that the model minority myth operates for Asian Americans, is that we in some ways get this weird and terrible benefit of the doubt that we're not criminals, right, in the same way that African Americans are assumed to be.
Are you at all concerned, or is there a mounting, you know, as far as concern out there that this is going to reach concerning levels as this anti-Asian sentiment?
Sure, of course I'm concerned because it impacts me and a lot of people that I care about. That any time we're walking down the street, you know, or going grocery shopping, something might happen. So I will say that I did happen to watch like the final speech that Donald Trump gave on Inauguration Day, you mm-hmm. know, and again, of course, he used that term China virus. And it was yeah. It was to be expected, but it was still really demoralizing.
Right.
So there is some optimism in that we have a new administration, you know, and they have actually literally put out a memo, right, that said we need to pay attention to this issue of xenophobia and hate crimes against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. But of course, that hasn't stopped them from happening. So I think it's something that won't go away unless people in power take concrete steps to address it.
Right. It's not going to go away. And of course, it is concerning and alarming. So do you feel like this new administration does have a heads up that this is something that needs to be addressed pretty soon?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely. So at least we can breathe that sigh of relief on that level, you know, and I hope that heads up will, again, translate into and filter down, really, so that, again, in places like in Indiana and the small towns and the big cities in Indiana, that we have political leaders, community leaders that are aware of this issue and that, you know, actually care that these kinds of things don't happen in our cities and towns and rural areas.
Well, I want to again mention that you are the author of The Color of Success, Asian Americans and the Origins of the Model Minority. And you have a new book that you're working on. Can you share a little more about that?
Sure, I'd love to. I'm writing really a sequel to this first book, and I'm calling it right now Overrepresented, The Surprising History of Asian Americans and Racial Justice. So it is exactly what that subtitle says. I am writing a history of racial justice with Asian Americans at the center, and I'm hoping that history gives us some fresh insights into what we might call diversity. I think this history will give us insight into the importance of data, as we've been talking about, data in racial justice, and also insight into democracy. And so it's really, in a lot of ways, a political history of, you know, a civic engagement history of Asian Americans, but very concretely, the relationship, the kind of conflicted, I would say, relationship that Asian Americans have had with African Americans, you know, and so I'm interested in those tensions and those contradictions and those conflicts, but I'm also interested in the promises of that relationship.
Oh, racial justice and injustice has been in the forefront, it seems like, specifically over the last year.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's not something new, but there is something. What is new is mm-hmm. the amount of attention I think that so many Americans are giving racial justice concerns. So that's pretty hopeful, but I weigh that against a lot of scary stuff too, you know? I mean, we've seen, especially with the recent events in Washington, D.C., how powerful the polar opposite of that is. You know, white supremacy, the far right white nationalists, you know, that is an issue where I live in Bloomington has been a really big matter of concern for a while. So it spins my head in a way. So I try to channel my energy about that into working on this research.
Yeah. What concerning things in Bloomington are you referring about?
Well, specifically, I'm thinking about the debate that the city has been dealing with since really 2019 about the farmers, the city farmers market, and the presence of vendors at the market who are essentially like neo-Nazi far-right sympathizers. And there's been a lot of racial justice work here in Bloomington, pushed back by activists. To ask the city to stand more clearly on the side of racial justice and really to take into account the safety of community members that, you know, would like to shop at a farmer's market that doesn't have, far-right white nationalist vendors.
What other kind of research are you going to put into this new book?
I'm looking at a huge spread. So I'm starting with the Asian American involvement in the civil rights movement, really, in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And I'm fast forwarding it all the way through 2020. So the last chapter of the book is going to be about the incredible, unprecedented events of 2020, but specifically from Asian Americans' own experiences and points of view. So a lot of the stuff you and I have been talking about over the past hour.
Anything that you've learned from writing that first book that you're going to take into the second one?
I think one lesson I'm really working on is to be a better writer and, you know, to find the stories that I think will really engage people. So that's pretty challenging because it's not always what we're trained to do as academic historians. But I think at the end of the day, people do really want a compelling story. And so that is something I'm striving towards.
Yeah, it's a lot of information. It's a lot to put together and compile and put it into something that, you know, that makes sense for people.
I think, and it's, you can't really rush it. Like, I'm very slow when it comes to writing, but the research, the archival work alone, you know, I've already visited some 30 different archives, and it just takes a lot of time. So I totally agree. It's a lot of information.
How do you think this new book, or maybe your first book, could help others? I mean, is this something that you think could be used as a learning tool?
I hope so. I mean, I'm learning from the research. And one thing I'm learning a lot about right now is how what I would call the Black Freedom Movement or the Civil Rights Movement really opened up a space for Asian Americans to make their needs, their grievances heard, and to, have them addressed. So one thing I would say for Asian Americans, I think it's really instructional to know that so much of what we enjoy today, the comforts, the privileges in American life, we really owe a big debt of gratitude to African Americans.
Most certainly. When can we expect this new book?
Supposedly,
not to put any pressure on you or anything, but
oh, no,
is there
okay.
a deadline?
There is a deadline. The book is probably going to come out in 2023, and it will be published by Princeton University Press.
That's impressive. That's very impressive. And then what's the next book? And then the next one, right? There's always more.
There's always more. I do have one idea for next book, and that is to write a history of immigration in the United States as a history of war. And I think that's something that we don't often think about, those two things together. But mm-hmm. I do really believe, and I teach about this, that if we think about immigration as a history of war and militarization, we get a really fresh take on it. And then we also realize how deeply war and militarization, really structures the whole immigration experience.
Yeah. Well, I would love to come to IU and take one of your classes. I would love to go back. You are extremely fascinating, and good luck with this new book.
Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. I'll take it.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, thank you for taking time to be on our show today. We appreciate it.
Very happy to be here. Thanks so much, Taylor.
We're talking to Ellen Wu, an associate professor of history and the director of the Asian American Studies Program at IU Bloomington. She is also the author of The Color of Success, Asian Americans and the Origins of the Model Minority, and as you heard, also coming out with a new book. Our producers are Drew Dahlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer, and he also composed this theme song. If you like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcast. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Taylor Bennett. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All In.